The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. I'll give him a bit of a morning off this morning as there's plenty to do at headquarters, like he mentioned yesterday, with all of the different youth activities coming up and the dance activity, the summer educational program. It's going to be a very busy summer. And just with all the regular events that are going on, it's always pretty busy in God's work, and especially at headquarters over in Edmond. Well, why are statues coming down around the world? Why do we have all of this video footage of Thomas Jefferson or Winston Churchill or American soldiers, you know, being toppled, or even people perhaps you hadn't heard of before until they started pulling their statues down? We're being told that this is about slavery. That's the main justification that they're being used. Oh, this person was a slave owner, or this person held shares in a company that traded slaves. And that this is about ending kind of the celebration of slave owners and getting rid of those monuments. Is that what is really under attack here? Well, no, it's not. It's about something much more insidious, and that's what I want to focus on today. What is really under attack with these statues coming down? And to understand that, we need to understand a few things, but we need to get a good history of slavery. And we're not going to ignore it, but let's look at what is Britain and America's history, really, with slavery. How do these two nations stand out in their history with slavery? Now, slavery and the way it was practiced through a huge amount of history, it's a great evil. And I think probably, this is something that actually does tend to get covered at history in school. So I think it's something we're probably familiar with, some of just the abominable conditions in slave ships and the treatment of a lot of slaves and different plantations and mines and all these things. So, a great evil, but it's also an evil that just about every civilization in the history of mankind has engaged in. You can look back at the earliest city-states in ancient Mesopotamia and see them taking people captive and enslaving them. You can look back at the ancient Greeks and find them boasting about their freedom and writing about how much they love freedom and democracy, while at the same time owning slaves and having economies that just run on slaves and slavery. You have the Roman Empire that was built on the backs of millions upon millions of slaves in the so-called Dark Ages that followed the fall of Rome. You see the slave trade just rife, with Vikings taking a massive part of it and many others, Arabs trading slaves. In about 1000 AD, you had an estimated 500,000 slaves being traded between Europe and Asia every year. 500,000. That's bigger even than more slaves being traded each year than the transatlantic slave trade. You've got the huge Muslim empires that grew up practicing huge amounts of slavery. You have, as Europe becomes more and more prosperous, you have slavery starting to die out, or serfdom, and kind of a form of slavery starting to die out in most of Europe, except for Russia, that keeps that going well into the 19th century. And then you see, with the discovery of America, the institution of slavery getting a huge boost, especially in the tropical region, slavery becomes big business in the centuries after Columbus. Those areas that were great for, there were areas there that were great for growing sugar, which was hugely profitable, fantastic cash crop, but it was really hard work. The area were full of diseases. Nobody wanted to do it. Lots of people died when you made them do it. And so European nations started bringing in slaves to do that. And it was a monstrous crime. It was one Britain fully participated in. About 3 million slaves were transported by British ships into the New World, into the Americas. America obviously had slavery in the South. But it wasn't just these ones participating in the crime. And in fact, both of these powers were unique in some different ways. There were a lot more than these two. Britain wasn't the only one trading slaves. As I said, Portugal, for example, they're estimated to have transported about 5.8 million slaves on its ship, nearly twice the amount that Britain did. But how much do you hear about Portugal in all of this talk about all this tearing down of statues, etc.? France transported somewhere around 2 million, 1.2 to 2 million, something like that. So another huge number. And then, of course, you had to buy the slaves from somewhere. And they often came through Arab markets, or they were sold by African rulers to the slave traders. One African king, King Gezo, he said, "The slave trade has been the ruling principle of my people. It is the source of their glory and wealth. Their songs celebrate their victories, and the mother lulls the child to sleep with notes of triumph over an enemy reduced to slavery." And then nor were British and American possessions in America, they weren't the only places for these slaves either. Brazil, for example, took in huge numbers. And the Portuguese parts of Latin America, Spanish parts as well. Huge numbers of slaves working in terrible conditions in the mines there. And the story of Britain's involvement in slavery is that of a nation getting tempted into something that it knows is wrong. Drawn in by a love of money. Early on in the expansion of Britain overseas, a British captain, he was in Africa, and someone offered to sell him some slaves, and he said, "Well, no, we are a people that do not deal in such commodities. Neither did we buy or sell one another or any that had our own shape." Now, he knew that it was wrong and said, "We're not going to participate." But that very soon became corrupted. Those principles went out the window. A slave could sell for 8 times the price in the Caribbean as he cost to buy in Africa. And you can imagine the way people at the time would have justified themselves. You know, everyone else is doing it. The Spanish are doing it. The Portuguese are doing it. If we refuse to trade in slaves, well, it's going to happen. But other nations are going to be the ones that make money doing it. But anyway, whatever the reason, whatever the justifications they used to justify itself, Britain got involved in the slave trade. And like I said, I'm not trying to justify those actions. All I'm saying is it was not unique. So if we're trying to understand, well, why are Britain and America statues coming down? Why is there this focus on these two countries? Well, you know, what makes them unique? And it wasn't the involvement in the slave trade. I can't think of any power or people that would be free of guilt from enslaving other people. But there is something that is truly unique about Britain and America's relationship with slavery. Something really dramatic. And that is that these two powers led the world in ending it. Now, the fact that slavery does still go on, and you don't hear that about that enough from a lot of these anti-slavery campaigners, that there's still a huge amount that goes on, but it's ended in the form that it's not generally legal. But if you think about it being ended, well, it's these two powers that were the ones that did that for the whole world. This is the way that these two powers stand out, ridding the world of slavery. Neil Ferguson, he made a great documentary series. Well, he made a book, Empire, and then they had a great documentary series based on it. And the whole series is available on YouTube if anyone on is interested. If you just search on something like Empire Neil Ferguson is the guy that writes computer models and then breaks them or ignores them. But Niall Ferguson, Empire series, and based on his book. But here's a section from that documentary series where he talks about slavery. This is clip one.
Today, British servicemen are in the West African state of Sierra Leone as peacekeepers. Their mission is a moral one, to help restore stability to a country that's been racked for years by civil war. Two 200 years ago, a Royal Navy squadron was based in Sierra Leone on a remarkably similar mission. They hadn't come to colonize or to conquer, but to prevent slave ships leaving the African coast for America. The Empire had become a force for good.
When the British first came to Sierra Leone back in 1562, it was as slave traders, and they spent the better part of the next two centuries shipping more than 3 million Africans across the Atlantic in chains. But then towards the end of the 18th century, something changed quite dramatically. It was as if a switch was flicked in the British psyche. Suddenly, they started shipping Africans back here in order to set them free.
So that was Neil Ferguson talking about slavery, talking about the slave trade. And in his book, he calls this change, this switch, he calls it an astonishing volte-face, Britain's abrupt change course on slavery. He writes that towards the end of the 18th century, something changed dramatically. It was almost as if, well, you heard him on the video there saying very similar words in that documentary. It was almost as if a switch was flicked in the British psyche. And suddenly, Britain did a 180 degree complete change on slavery. Here in, we saw video footage from Sierra Leone, and he was talking about that, and their freed slaves were set free and went. They were given a quarter of an acre of land, a cooking pot, a spade, and freedom. Why this abrupt change? Was it that slavery had stopped being profitable, stopped making money? Or was there massive rebellion, say, or a lot of pressure that was being brought to bear to force Britain to end the slavery? Well, no, it wasn't that at all. It was still phenomenally profitable. Instead, the middle classes were growing in power. Power was kind of slipping from the aristocracy, and the middle classes decided, well, slavery is immoral. And they shut it down. Here's just another short clip from that documentary, clip two.
And this wasn't because slavery had stopped being profitable. On the contrary, the British were intent on demolishing a pillar of their own imperial economy.
So they were pushing for slavery to end. And increasingly, politicians started it. One of the politicians that started a lot of this push to end slavery was Zachary Macaulay. He's the father of the great historian that you may have heard of. And he was a manager of a sugar plantation or sugar foundation, and he found himself sickened by the slavery that he saw. And so he ended up immersing himself kind of in the slave trade to get all of the details, to learn all that he could about it, to force himself to witness the atrocities. He traveled even across the Atlantic on a slave ship to see, what is it like? And then he went back to London, and he started to connect with like-minded politicians, and they started really trying to push to end this. Here's just a last clip from Neil Ferguson on these politicians.
You could say the moral transformation of the British Empire began right here in this church. Macaulay's fellow parishioners, who included the dazzling parliamentary orator William Wilberforce, combined evangelical zeal with hard-nosed political nous. The Clapham sect, as they were known, excelled at generating a new wave of grassroots activism.
From all over the country, petitions poured in. In Manchester alone, 11,000 people signed. So widespread was the popular revulsion that the government simply caved in. In 1807, they abolished the slave trade. It was as if a modern government, for purely moral reasons, had done away with the entire arms trade. Britain had just acquired an ethical foreign policy.
And as you read, there was a massive uptick in popular wave of popular outrage that led to this being outlawed. And it was a huge number of people that got involved. You look at the population of Manchester at the time, 11,000. It's a very significant number. Here's what he writes in his book. This is just from the book Empire. It's not easy to explain so profound a change in the ethics of a people. It used to be argued that slavery was abolished simply because it had ceased to be profitable. But all the evidence points the other way. In fact, it was abolished despite the fact that it was still profitable. What we need to understand, then, is a collective change of heart. And we'll read some more about some of the economic impacts of ending slavery in a little bit later. But Britain, then, you had this process of ending slavery. In 1772, you had a court case that limited slavery in England itself. There's still debate on exactly what the parameters of the case were. But you start to see legal cases coming in against it. 1793, you had the Parliament of Upper Canada abolishing the slave trade as the first of the colonies to do something like that. Wilberforce and others and Macaulay, they founded the Committee for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. And they had their work cut out to push this through. There were a lot of people benefiting from the slave trade, making money from the slave trade. And so there was a lot of obstacle to overcome. It was overwhelmingly in Britain's self-interest to keep this going. So they had to work hard. Then you had the French Revolution came, and right in the middle of their efforts to interrupt slavery or to stop slavery, and that caused a big disruption of their efforts. You know, Britain was kind of focused on fighting for its survival for a lot of this time. But then in 1807, still during the Napoleonic Wars, the slave trade was made illegal. But Britain didn't stop there. And we'll talk about America as well, which was acting at exactly the same time, kind of in lockstep with Britain. But as these Napoleonic Wars were going on, and then as they finished, well, Britain was emerging as the world's leading power. And so right away, they used that power to cajole, force, persuade other nations to outlaw the slave trade. So, for example, if you're looking at this time period, Britain is defending Portugal against French invasion. And Portugal is relying on Britain's help. And so they used that influence to get Portugal to end their slave trade in 1810. 1813, treaty with Sweden, ending Sweden's slave trade. 1814, well, Napoleon, you're getting right at the end of Napoleon now, Napoleon defeated, France signs the Treaty of Paris, where France agrees that the slave trade is repugnant to the principles of natural justice. That's a treaty they signed with Britain. And France promises to outlaw the slave trade within the next few years in this treaty with Britain. Then same year, you have the Anglo-Dutch Treaty, where the Netherlands outlaws the slave trade. You know, shortly afterwards, I think it was 1817, you have the Anglo-Spanish Treaty outlawing the slave trade. You have the UK going to some of these far-off places, going to like Zanzibar, for example, and you know, agreeing with Zanzibar that Zanzibar is going to shut down and its massive slave market. And you know, it was a diplomatic negotiated agreement. At the same time, there was the Royal Navy was kind of just sitting off, just off the coast of Zanzibar as a, gunboat diplomacy. You know, well, if you don't shut this down, there's a big fleet of Royal Navy ships out there and we might shut it down for you. No other nation was going around the world like this, cajoling other nations into ending the slave trade. There's no one else that keeps signing these treaties, nation after nation. Okay, well, you'll end the slave trade. Now we'll get you to end the slave trade. And like I said, America was moving in lockstep with Britain, exactly the same direction, same time, just about the only other country to unilaterally shut down the slave trade, not kind of being cajoled into it, persuaded into it, but just, you know, just doing it unilaterally. The US adopted its act prohibiting importation of slaves on the 2nd of March, 1807. I think that came into force the next year. But the same month, same year as Britain ending the slave trade, America abolishing the slave trade. Now, of course, abolishing the slave trade does not abolish slavery. In America, for example, it abolished the transatlantic slave trade, but slaves could still be bought and sold within America. And again, and the same within Britain, it abolished the slave trade, but slavery was still there in the British territories and colonies. But it was an important step. And the people that pushed hard for that step didn't stop there. They kept pushing and they kept pushing. And so in 1833, Britain passed the Slavery Abolition Act. And that abolished slavery in all British colonies. 800,000 slaves were freed as that act came into effect. Huge, nearly a million. And you know, it came into effect maybe different times around the year, and it didn't happen as quickly as a lot of people would like. And you know, you can certainly understand people being very impatient for their freedom. But 800,000 freed as that came into effect. Now, to get that through Parliament, it had to be compensated emancipation. The slave owners were paid for the slaves that they set free. And a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests are very critical, or protesters, they're very critical of that today, that the slave owners received money for freeing their slaves. And they say, well, you should have given that money to the slaves, in an ideal world, they would have been the slaves, I guess, that would have received compensation. But at the same time, you think about these people pushing for abolition. You know, they knew, well, we could go for compensated emancipation now and get this done with and get people freed. Or if we try to do it without compensation, it's going to take us much longer. It's going to be much more difficult. And they went for, well, let's just get it done. Let's get these people free. They were impatient to end it. And fine, even if we have to pay reparations to slave owners, it's not ideal. But if that's what it takes to free the slaves, we're willing to do, we'll do that. And we'll pay that money. And Britain paid a huge amount of money. Huge amount. To get those slaves free. It was £20 million in that money. But I think it was around 40% of annual government expenditure. It would have worked out as billions in today's money. In fact, it was so big. You know, Britain had to take off a loan to afford to pay all this money to free the slaves. And it was so big that we finished off paying that loan in 2015. 5 years ago, massive financial undertaking to get rid of slavery. And, well, Jan Morris, another book I'll bring up, this is from her trilogy on an Imperial or Pax Britannica trilogy. And this was Heaven's Command, the first one, just talking about the rise of that empire. And in it, she talks about the economic effects of ending slavery like this. And, well, she writes, economically, its results had been devastating. Planters were ruined from Antigua to Mauritius. Middlemen of Ashanti, slave captains of Merseyside, overseers of Nassau, found themselves without an occupation. Paupers proliferated in all slave colonies. Squatters defied the landlords. No, he talked about how it was very hard for a lot of these freed slaves as well. Or she does, sorry. She writes, most of the sugar colonies never recovered. And she gives one example of a Jamaican estate. In the 1820s, it was earning £11,000 a year. So bringing in that much money every year, £11,000. By the 1840s, after slavery had been abolished, it was sold for just £1,650. It was sold for a bit over a tenth of what it had been making each year before then. By the 1850s, it was said to be worth only £800. So going from making £11,000 a year to £800. Britain accepted, you know, it was very much against Britain's economic interest. But the nation said it's the right thing to do. And we're going to end the slave trade and outlaw slavery. But then, it wasn't enough just to end it within British territories and make sure that British captains were not transporting slaves, because, well, then there would still be a lot of slave trade going on, a lot of people in slavery to other countries. And so Britain went further. Britain, just about alone of all nations of the world, though again, America joined as you got closer, I think, to the Civil War, and then afterwards, we'll get to that in a minute, but at first, definitely just about alone, the UK put out a huge effort to shut this slave trade down. So even again, during these Napoleonic Wars, while Britain was fighting for survival, in 1808, Britain set up the West Africa Squadron. And the job of the West Africa Squadron was to shut down slavery, to patrol the seas off the west coast of Africa, looking for slave ships. And if they found them, to free the slaves. And to arrest or fine the captains. And it was hard. They weren't as successful as we would have liked. The slave ships were often built for speed, and the Royal Navy battleships were built to do well in battle. And so often these slave ships were able to outrun the Royal Navy. And then even when they did overhaul them, dealing with slave ships was a bureaucratic nightmare, because Britain's authority to stop and search ships, well, that was based upon all of these different treaties. And each treaty with each different country was different. And so there were different rights and powers they had depending on which nation's ship they'd overhauled. For example, for some countries, if the ship had didn't have any slaves but still had manacles and chains and was, you know, had all the equipment necessary to be a slave ship, well, that was enough. It could be called a slave ship and be dealt with. Whereas for other countries, based on their treaty, there actually had to be slaves present before the Royal Navy could take any action. And in theory, all of these other countries had signed up to stop the slave trade and to help patrol the coast looking for slaves. In practice, none of them really did much, and a lot of them worked hard to kind of frustrate what the Royal Navy was doing. So it was a tough job, and then you have similar problems that you even seen with America in modern times, dealing with pirates in Somalia, where you'd have independent kingdoms on land and captains would have no authority to go and chase ships onto the land and to shut down slavery there. So it wasn't easy, but still, Britain put a lot of money into shutting down the slave trade, and as we'll see, it got more and more effective as time went on. But the Navy captured 1,600 ships between 1808 and 1860, with 150,000 Africans freed. So it was still a big effort to shut down slave trade. And this is something the Royal Navy used to be really proud of. This is an ad put together by Britain's Royal Navy, and I think it's just about 10 years old, maybe a little more, 12, 13, 14. So this is how they talk about their history. Clip 4.
Their bodies were the marks of cruelty. Their pride was crushed by the shame of being poor and sold. 200 years ago, Britain abolished the slave trade, but it didn't stop there. Someone had to enforce the ban. Men who were prepared to risk disease and death to end the evil trade. Who hunted down the slavers and freed the slaves? The Royal Navy. Today, we're still out there, delivering vital humanitarian aid, getting people out of war-torn areas, stopping illegal drugs, protecting ships from piracy, and yes, still fighting slavery. Right now, somewhere in the world, men and women of your Royal Navy are working for you, making the world a better place.
So like I said, that was just a few years ago. They would talk much more about this history. But you know, Britain just kept having to get more and more involved to try and shut down the slave trade. And it took the kind of toxic masculinity, quote unquote, that the left loves to hate, that all of these Antifa and Black Lives Matter protesters denounce and protest against. It took that toxic masculinity to end slavery. For example, the type of person that that helped do this was a Royal Navy commander named Joseph Denman. So in 1840, you had a major slave trading tribe or territory, Galenus, and the Royal Navy, well, they had no right to go in there. They couldn't. They knew that slavery was happening, slave trade was happening. Commander Denmas was on a ship patrolling the coast, but he wasn't allowed to go on land and deal with it. But then the leaders there of this tribe, well, they kidnapped somebody from a black woman from Sierra Leone who was a British citizen. Well, and that gave Commander Denman the pretext that he needed, the authorization that he needed to go in there. And he grabbed that with both hands. He wasn't at war. Well, Britain wasn't at war with this territory at the time, but as Jan Morris put it, acting Nelsonically on his own, he grabbed this opportunity. He went in there with his crew of sailors, freed the British subject, but then took over the Galenus, one of their biggest islands, freed over 1,000 slaves, burned all their warehouses, forced the tribal chief to sign a treaty renunciating the slave trade. and stamped it out in that small area, at least for a short period of time. And as you get on beyond 1833 into 1840, 1850, these kind of actions become more common, getting on land to try and stamp out this slave trade. In 1850, with Lord Palmerston as Prime Minister, he allowed the Royal Navy to enter Brazilian waters, which was a major center for the slave trade, to go after slavers there. And they wiped out the Brazilian slave trade in about a year. And then, as I said, getting more and more involved in Africa and African politics, African territory, to try and end the slave trade. Not to colonize at this point, but to go in there and to end, or not to, to grab resources, but to go in there and end the slave trade. And then meanwhile, of course, you had important developments in the United States, ones that I'm sure you're very familiar with as you build up to the Civil War and slavery becomes more and more of a political issue. You have a strong abolition movement building in the North. And I know that war was about more than slavery, but at the same time, slavery was at its heart. You had thousands upon thousands of Americans fighting and dying for freedom, and a freedom that they believed extended to, well, as it says in the American Declaration, extended to all men. And they were willing to fight and die for that. And that war ended with about 4 million slaves being freed. 4 million. And then that war also unified America against the slave trade. It led to America providing more help to the Royal Navy and to Britain, stamping out the slave trade overseas. The two, for example, worked together to force Cuba to end the slave trade. And that pretty much, after the American Civil War and shortly afterwards, that was pretty much the end of the West African slave trade, stamped out by Britain and America. Now, it wasn't the end of slavery. For the UK, for example, you had Dr. Livingston exposed a lot of slavery. David Livingston still going on. No relation, I don't think, to our producer. No, Sam shaking his head. I think it's spelt differently anyway, if I remember correctly. But a lot of slavery still going on, and he brought it to people's attention going on in East Africa with the Arab slave trade and the Arabs trading African slaves over in the East. And so from about 1860, 1870, Britain's anti-slavery attention shifted over to East Africa. And the Royal Navy got active there, trying to shut that slave trade down as well. A slave trade that Britain had never really been involved in. But, well, we've got to end it. It's evil. In 1890, even, Britain gave Germany an important island in the North Sea as a swap for Zanzibar. And why did Britain want Zanzibar? Again, well, not necessarily to found a colony, but because it was a great spot, a useful base for shutting down the slave trade. And so this is the history that makes Britain and America unique, different. The only thing that I can think of that's even remotely comparable is Russia's ending of serfdom in 1861, where they freed 23 million slaves. Or serfs. I mean, I guess serfdom's slightly different to slavery, but still very similar. And, well, the fact that Russia was still employing 23 million slaves, you know, dramatically more than even in the South, all the way on into the 1860s, isn't something that gets talked about so much. And even here, it wasn't motivated by the same kind of sense of moral values. Tsar Alexander II, when he freed all the serfs, he said that it was in part because he believed it is better to liberate the peasants from above and then to wait for them to rise up and to, you know, demand that liberty from below. So he was kind of jumping before he was pushed. And even then, well, it was an ending of slavery only within the Russian Empire. But you have this unique way that Britain and America ended up freeing the whole world of slavery. So look at this full, you know, undisputed, full history. I don't know of any kind of left-wing historians or academics or any of the protesters that would really dispute any of the facts that I've just told you. I think it's pretty much unanimously accepted among historians. There's plenty of documents to prove it. You know, no one really denies this, but they don't talk about it. And with this whole history in mind, well, none of what this, the Black Lives Matter movements and these people staring down the statues, none of it makes sense. If you think about the people, some of the people that these are, that they're targeting, Mr. Flurry talked about Sir John Hawkins, this Elizabethan naval commander who really, well, he laid the foundation. I've got that quote from Britannica here, if I can manage to turn my page. There we go. One of the foremost seamen of the 16th century and the chief architect of the Elizabethan Navy. So one of the people that really built up Britain's naval tradition, that played a huge role in setting up Britain's naval power. And of course, we know that God was using these men. But nonetheless, you know, a man God was using that had a huge role in setting that foundation for Britain to become a naval power. They're also going after Sir Francis Drake. Again, another huge figure from British history that played a major role in setting up the Royal Navy. So that 100, 200, 300 years later, it could be a major power in the world. Admiral Nelson, he's another one. Horatio Nelson, that's come under attack. They've been throwing paint over statues of Nelson and trying to graffiti him. But if you think about it, if it weren't for Sir John Hawkins, if it weren't for Drake, if it weren't for Nelson, well, would you have had a Royal Navy that beat the French at the Battle of Trafalgar? Would you have a Royal Navy that kept Napoleon from invading Britain? And Napoleon assembled a massive army to go and invade Britain, an army that, you know, at that time, Britain never really had a big, strong army. It was always a much smaller professional force for being used overseas. It was the Navy that was the real pillar of Britain's defense. And if France, well, Napoleon said something, I didn't write the quote down, it just comes to mind now. If I can be a master of the channel for but half a day, well, then I'll be master of the world. Just long enough, he could keep the Royal Navy at bay just long enough to get his army into England, he would have beaten England, and he would have become master of the world. And it was Lord St. Vincent, the first Lord of the Admiralty at the time. He said, I do not say the French cannot come. I only say they cannot come by sea. It was the Royal Navy that kept the French out. So, well, what would have happened if it weren't for the Royal Navy? If that Royal Navy weren't built up and strong? If men like Drake and Nelson, Drake and Hawkins hadn't kind of really set down deep roots of a naval tradition in the Elizabethan years, if it weren't for great commanders like Horatio Nelson, well, Napoleon would have taken over the world. Would have been a massive French empire. Well, then would slavery have ever been eliminated? In this kind of world of what ifs, would we still have slavery today? I mean, we can never know these kind of counter histories, counterfactuals. But there's no evidence that if any other power had become the dominant power in the world, that slavery would ever have been ended. And again, I'm saying ended, and I should add that important disclaimer that slavery is still present and is still going on at a huge level, much more than we like to think about. And I think, really, you look at, I mean, for the Victorians and for the British Empire in Victorian times, it wasn't enough for them to just outlaw slavery within their territory and within their ships. They wanted to make sure that the whole world was complying with that. And we quite clearly don't have the same zeal that even they had. These people that we paint and graffiti, we don't have the same zeal that they have for eradicating evil. We're, in fact, more tolerant of slavery than the Victorians were, whose statues that we knock over and that we call racist. So there is still a huge amount of slavery going on, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But in terms of ending this slave trade and ending slavery as, say, a legal institution, would that have happened if you had a different empire dominating the world? There is no evidence that it would. There's every indication that if it weren't for the rise of the British Empire and then for the rise of America as well, you know, these two powers are unique in world history in stamping out slavery. And if you had some kind of different history, it would probably still be here today. You go, the mob, they also went after Queen Victoria. They were painting painting slogans on her statue, you know, calling her racist and colonialist and slave owner. There are pictures of her, like I said, her statue graffitied. Well, it was during the Victorian times that a whole lot of this stamping out of slavery happened. She presided over an empire that got rid of slavery and sure had its faults. I'm definitely not saying the British Empire was perfect, but had this unique impact on world history. And what about Thomas Jefferson, who we saw his statue being pulled down over the weekend, who's coming under more and more attack? You know, yes, okay, he was a slave owner who believed slavery was wrong, so obviously not a perfect individual, but the principles that he put forward in the Declaration of Independence, well, and that he espoused throughout his life, those principles, you know, did a huge amount towards ending slavery. You know, he wrote the words that inspired many to go out and fight for freedom. He established that, you know, he helped establish that those documents and played a role with the Declaration of Independence, I guess less so with the Constitution. That played a massive role in world history in bringing freedom to people. So what's the real reason, going back to what I said at the beginning, what's the real reason for the attack on these statues, for tearing down Thomas Jefferson, for graffitiing Queen Victoria, for boxing up Winston Churchill? Well, to understand that, we need to understand why Britain and America became great in the first place. And then we can understand what is really under attack here. We'll take a short break, and then when we get back, we'll get back into that.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity and our ancestry. Request the United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free one-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Sorry for that slightly awkward video switch there if you're watching on the YouTube stream. We sent Parker back to America, so we are a little short-staffed in the studio over here. Sam's scooting around on his wheelie chair trying to man what's usually a couple of stations. We're kind of in between loads of students here at Edstone. We've got a few getting ready to go back. And it will be a few weeks before we start to get replenished. But anyway, before the break, we were talking about, well, what's the real reason that British and American history is under attack? When these nations actually played a very unique role in ending slavery, not necessarily a unique role in promoting it. Well, what's the real reason? Well, there's something astonishing. Even historians our region are saying, call it miraculous, about the rise of Britain and America around the year 1800. Now, historians struggle to understand it. You even heard Ferguson, where he talking about right around that time, the end of the 18th century, that it was like a switch was suddenly flicked. Something changed, and he was talking about the attitude towards slavery, but something changed suddenly at this time. This is from Paul Johnson's book on English history called The Offshore Islanders. And he talks about lots of changes going on in Britain around this time. Well, he says the English Industrial Revolution of 1780 to 1820, so this time period that I'm talking about, is the great watershed in the history of mankind. So something huge in man's history happening at this time. It liberated the body as the Reformation had liberated the mind. In fact, the two were intimately connected. And he goes through some of what went into that. And then he says, by the early 1780s, when all the economic indices took a sudden and sharp upward turn. So suddenly, economic indices, you know, all of those different things that you look at to find out, well, how rich is a nation? How prosperous is a nation? How well it is doing? Right around 1780 and in the next few decades, they all went very positive. They took a sudden turn. Some elements, I said it sharply upwards, England's situation was unique. Some of the elements required for an economic transformation were present in other parts of the world, but only England possessed them all in combination. The miracle, and he puts miracle in quotes there, but still, the miracle had been brewing for 150 years. Or to vary the metaphor, a number of conventional factors of economic growth had been drawn together, and in the late 18th century, the resulting mass became critical, and the explosion took off. So you had something unique, something huge, an explosion, a miracle even. In the words of this secular historian, happening around 1780, and I don't have time to get into it, but you can, I think we might even do an infographic on this for an upcoming Trumpet print, but you look at some of the charts, I'll hold it up for the camera if you're watching on the YouTube stream, but you can see, for example, England's population, these are very crude charts that I made in Excel, but you can see the population of England just goes through a massive change right around 1800, slow and steady growth, and then just explodes. Even food production, between about 1550 and by the time you reach 1800, the amount of food that you're getting from per acre of field has roughly tripled. So Britain's suddenly getting much more out of its food, and the British Empire takes off. Well, why does that happen? And why does it happen at that time period? Well, if we're trying to understand a miracle, well, the Bible's the logical place to go to understand that. And you can go to Genesis chapter 12, and you can see where this really comes from. It comes from God making some promises to Abraham, or Abram, as he's still called now. We look in Genesis chapter 12, and in verse 1, God tells Abram to get you out from your country and from your kindred and from your father's house and into a land that I will show you. And God says, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you and curse them that curse you. And in you shall all families of the world be blessed. So God makes some huge promises here to Abraham, some really important promises. Oh, I got thunder. You had that yesterday a bit. I was hoping to play football later. Hopefully we can still do that. Anyway, back to Genesis chapter 12. So God makes some promises to Abraham. Now, some of these promises are a promise, or Mr. Armstrong referred to it as a promise of grace. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, you know, there's a promise there of a Messiah that would be descended from Abraham. But there's another promise too, where God says, I will make of you a great nation. A promise of a nation having national greatness. It's more than just it's more than promising Jesus Christ. There's another promise there. A promise that God would bless Abraham. And we don't really have time to turn there, but you can see in Genesis chapter 48 and also in 1 Chronicles 1 that this promise of a great nation, it was passed on to two of Jacob's children, Ephraim and Manasseh. God promised that they would be great nations, that they would be the ones that would inherit this national promise. This promise of a nation, Ephraim and Manasseh. And then you can go through and you can look at the history of Israel in the Bible. You can see that the nation of Israel split in half, that the kingdom of Judah became one kingdom, and then the kingdom of Israel that included Ephraim and Manasseh, they became another kingdom, independent from Judah. And this kingdom of Israel, they went into captivity right around between 721 and 721 and 718 BC. So what happened? You know, God promised not just Abraham, but specifically Ephraim and Manasseh, you're going to become a great nation. Massive promises, more than just what was fulfilled anciently. You can go through and read in several of these places in Genesis where God promised, you know, huge amounts of power to these nations, power that they didn't receive as part of ancient Israel. And then they get taken into captivity in 721. Well, what happens? What happened to those promises? Did God just forget about them? Well, we see the answer in Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus chapter 26, this chapter where God talks to ancient Israel and he says, well, if you obey me, here are the blessings that you'll receive. And if you disobey me, here are the punishments that you'll receive. And in Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 18, God's talking about these curses. And he says, if you do not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. Seven times more for your sins. And there's an important message for us here in this verse, that expression seven times. It comes from the Hebrew shiba. It can mean sevenfold. Mr. Armstrong explained that this could mean seven times worse punishment, seven times more intense punishment. But also the way that it's worded here, it implies duration, seven times longer. Seven times of continuous punishment. And now in Bible prophecy, the time is a specific period. And if you want to know more about this, I'm summarizing very quickly what's in Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But in the Bible, a time is a specific time period, 360-day year. So seven times more for your sins, or that could read, well, seven times 360 days, or 2,560 days. And there's something else that's talked about in the Bible, in Numbers 14, for example, a day for a year prophecy, where God, or principle, where the Bible talks about days, but then the actual fulfillment, each day is a year. So if we apply that to 2,520 days, you get 2,000, I might have said a different number earlier, sorry, but you get 2,000, Britain, or Ephraim and Manasseh being punished for 2,520 years. The blessings that are promised here, they would be withheld for 2,520 years. And so they go into captivity in 721 to 718 BC. They disappear. And those blessings are withheld for 2,520 years. And 2,520 years after they go into captivity, those blessings are rained out down upon them. And what is 2,520 years later? You can do the math if you want. But it comes out to being around 1800 AD. Just around that time that these historians are talking about, well, a miraculous change in world events. And, you know, the rest of Leviticus chapter 26 lists all these specific prophecies that would be given to Britain. And I even have some of these scriptures written in the margin of this history book as Paul Johnson goes through and talks about all of the different astonishing changes that took place in Britain at this time. It's just so clear, even just reading the history book and then the Bible alongside it. Well, God promised this, and then, well, this secular historian writing in complete ignorance of Leviticus 26 says, well, they received it. So a massive, important event in world history. And this is the history, this is the connection that is really under attack here. When these statues are attacked, when these radical left mobs tear down these figures from British and American history, they're attacking God's history with Israel, God's prophecy with Israel. Mr. Armstrong wrote that, well, he called this let me find the quote. In the United States and Britain in Prophecy, he called it the most astonishing proof of the Bible and of the existence of it's the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible, and at the same time, the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God. You could also have a look in Joshua 5 and verse 24, where back then God is performing a miracle for Israel, parting the Jordan. But then in that verse, God says, well, I'm not just performing this miracle for Israel now. He says, I'm doing it that all the people of the earth might know that the hand of the Eternal, that it is mighty, that you might fear the Eternal, your God, forever. So when God is working with Israel and pouring out these blessings upon Israel, he's doing so with the whole world in mind. He's teaching a lesson to the entire world. He's showing the whole world, if you want blessings, well, you know, there's a great God that said that decides when nations are going to be great, that promises it, that fulfills it. That's the way to have blessings, to be a prosperous nation, to turn to God. There's a message here for the whole world. And when these people tear down these statues, when they look at that history and they say, well, Britain and America are only great because of slavery and because they stole all their wealth from everybody else. When they spread those lies, what they're really attacking is that connection with God. And ultimately, there's an evil spirit behind it, attacking that connection with God. And it's that history with God, that proof of the Bible that brings the Bible alive, and God's dramatic purpose for Israel that's really under attack here. You can learn more from that from our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. There's lots more to get into here. I probably will get into it in an article later this week. But please do order that book. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. And you can always get in touch with us as well at td@kpcg.fm.